My name is Ed. I was a Jehovah's Witness for about 33 years, kind of brought up in it. I got baptised in the 80s, and through that I, at some point, became what's called a minister servant, and then I came to be what's called an elder, who is somebody who shepherds the congregation, looks after the members.
So was it your parents that they joined the Jehovah's Witnesses?
Well, my mum was a Jehovah's Witness, my dad wasn't, and that's basically the only people that were in the religion.
Give us an idea of what it meant to be an elder. How does the Jehovah's Witness Church, how does it organise a congregation?
Okay, so in every congregation you have what's called a body of elders, and the way you become an elder is you sort of have to qualify spiritually by what the Bible's qualifications are in Timothy and Titus, and then you become a minister or servant.
So what are those qualifications? Sorry, I should know my Bible a bit better.
It's okay, yeah. The qualifications are you have to be what's called a spiritual man, and so in the Bible, in Timothy, it talks about a minister or servant should be such and such and such, so they have to be, you know the Bible well, they have to be, have good qualifications, and members of the flock have to see those qualities in you. And once you become a ministerial servant, so you sort of, as a servant, you support the elders to do, like, maybe not menial tasks, but not the teaching responsibilities in the congregation. So then once you start to get the qualifications of an elder, which is also featured in Timothy as well, the body of elders kind of vote on whether you have the qualifications to become an elder, and then you join the elders. And in every congregation you have what's called a body of elders, and they can range in number from 3 or 4 to maybe 18 to 20.
Depending on the size of the congregation. So what about your progress through that? How did you find it as an elder, and what were your duties?
Well, as an elder, your responsibilities are mainly to shepherd the flock. So you give encouraging shepherding calls.
What's that?
An encouraging shepherding call is where you have to, with a fellow elder, or if it's not dealing with, like, a difficult matter, you would take a ministerial servant with you to the home of one of the members of the congregation, and you would prepare a little thing beforehand just to encourage them. If it's something that you've got to take along another elder, that means, you know, you have to deal with a matter, and so you go to the home. But normally you would just go along and you would try and encourage them, look at certain aspects where they might be able to improve in their service, and things like that.
It sounds to me a little bit like what you get as a sort of review from management in a business.
I suppose so, yeah, because as an elder, you try to encourage the flock to do more and more and more.
What about the services that the JWs hold? Is it a Sunday, a Saturday? How does it all work?
Well, originally, when I became a witness, there were, they call them 5 meetings a week, but there were 3. So you would have a Sunday meeting where you would have a public talk. So that means an elder or a qualified minister or servant would get up in front of the congregation and do a 45-minute talk.
So is this like a long sermon?
Yeah, it is. The society, the Watchtower Urban Tract Society, provide the outline, and you have to develop the talk from the outline, but you've got to keep very, very closely to the outline.
So is the idea that all the different congregations around the country are doing a similar sort of thing each Sunday?
Yeah, that's something that the witnesses like to say, in the fact that you could go anywhere in the world and they believe exactly the same thing. So, for instance, the outlines, when they gave a public talk, there were about 130 to 140 outlines, and you as a speaker would have a choice of developing those. You could, you know, you could have 10, 20, 30 outlines in your amount of public talks that you do. So that will be the public talk.
So this is on a Sunday, but you talked about various other things through the week. I mean, it sounds like quite a lot going on.
Oh, it was. It's dominating your life, because in addition to the Sunday meeting, of course, you'd have the Watchtower study going through a Watchtower article every week. So that'd be the Sunday public talk and Watchtower study. Then years ago, they used to have what's called the book study, where you would go into someone's home. There'd be a group of about maybe 15 of you, and you go into someone's home and you would go through one of the publications from, you know, start to finish of the publication. And then when that one's finished, you go on to another publication, maybe one that was just released. So that would be the Tuesday group. And then on Thursday, you're then being taught how to do your ministry. So it was something that was called the Theocratic Ministry School. And then, you know, you would do little talks in front of the congregation and Bible readings and things like that to get you used to doing it in front of somebody, and that trains them to go then from door to door.
It does sound like a lot of your time is taken up with this. So, I mean, how is it that, you know, how do Jehovah's Witnesses interact with the general public, say, for example, through work, your neighbours, that sort of thing?
Well, you're there to be a good example to everybody. So, obviously, good example to your fellow brothers and sisters, and then you would be a good neighbour. You know, it's your duty to keep your car clean and, you know, your garden tidy and things like that.
The question, though, is you left. This is the interesting thing, because it sounds to me like quite a cosy and possibly, you know, nurturing environment to be around lots of people that believe similar or the same things. But you decided to leave.
I did, yeah, and it was tough. It really was difficult, because you think about the way the witnesses think and feel about matters. Your whole social network are Jehovah's Witnesses. So therefore, let's say your parents were Jehovah's Witnesses. That means you're the next line of Jehovah's Witnesses then, the next generation. And maybe what if your grandparents were in it and your great-grandparents were in it? That means you're going to get aunties and uncles who are all Jehovah's Witnesses. So your whole social network are Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah, for a lot of Jehovah's Witnesses, their friends and family won't be.
No, that's true. So you're encouraged really to not have what they call worldly associates. You just keep them at arm's distance. So you said before about in work. Yes, you'd be friendly towards those at work, in work environment, but you certainly wouldn't make them friends. You wouldn't have friends amongst them.
So, I mean, as quite a senior person in the Jehovah's Witnesses, as an elder, it must have been something fairly serious that made you start thinking about, well, this isn't necessarily for me.
It was. It wasn't that I didn't believe what they taught. That was the first issue for me. I believed everything, and I did since the moment I became a Jehovah's Witnesses until I started to think about leaving. It was purely the way they treat people for me.
Well, can you go into that? What do you mean? Surely this is a Christian organisation. People are going to be treated kindly, one would hope.
Yeah, that's right, it is. But when you think about witnesses in general, what most people don't know about them is probably the shunning policy that they have, the disfellowshipping policy. And so when somebody is what's called disfellowshipped, they are literally cut off from everybody in the organisation. Not a single person would ever talk to them again until they get reinstated.
Okay, so how does somebody get identified for possibly being disfellowshipped?
Okay, so if a member of the congregation had committed a sin, and they know what a sin is because we go through sin all the time through meetings, if they committed a sin, they would be duty-bound to go and talk to an elder. And an elder might be somebody...
Well, this reminds me a bit of the Catholic confession.
Well, it is, yeah. With a Catholic confession, you only get to really talk about one person in a box, don't you? You're sat next to them and the person confesses and they're forgiven based on how they feel about it. With a Jehovah's Witness, you would have to go to an elder. Then that elder would say, well, thank you for telling me. And he would then go back to the body of elders. And the body of elders would discuss it, but not the detail. They would discuss it and say, well, we need another brother to go and talk to them. And so that would be what's called an investigative committee. So that would be two. So they would go and talk to them and see how they feel about it. Then if it was established that they had committed a serious sin to warrant judicial action, then those two would go back to the body and say, yes, we find out that it requires a judicial committee. And so then a judicial committee would be set up, and that could be anything from three elders. If it was a complicated case, then they would have more on it. But normally it's about three elders, and they would have to then meet with the person and discuss how they felt about it.
Now, I can imagine if I was a Jehovah's Witness and I sinned, I probably wouldn't want to go and tell an elder about it, because if I was to, it sounds like is a whole massive procedure then starts to roll into motion.
It would do, and every witness knows that they are duty bound to confess their sins to elders. So it's like a second nature. If you didn't tell them, you'd have such a guilty conscience, and it would weigh down upon them so much it would be visible.
Okay, so do elders ever sin?
Absolutely they do. Yes, there are many elders. I sat on some myself, on fellow elders, yes.
Okay, so can you just tell me about what were you so unhappy about, this, the way that people were treated during this process?
Well, there are personal things I don't really want to go into, obviously. But I think it's just the whole idea that you can be completely cut off from your whole support network. And sadly, it has got some so down that you imagine that you would basically, let's say with social media, the moment you become disfellowshipped and you had maybe friends on Facebook and things like that, those people would literally just block you because you're now a disfellowshipped Jehovah's Witness. And so they won't talk to you. Even your family, they won't talk to you. And sadly, I didn't discuss with this before, but you now have a situation where there are children getting baptised as ages as low as 9 or 10. So you imagine you're a little Jehovah's Witness at the age of 9 or 10. You don't really know what you're signing yourself up to. And then say they went to a birthday party, because Jehovah's Witnesses aren't allowed to celebrate birthdays. If that child went to a birthday party and it was found out, they could end up in one of these judicial committees. And let's say they weren't sorry. So a child then would be in the just terrible situation where they would be disfellowshipped. And so nobody in the Kingdom Hall would speak to a 9 or 10 year old child. I don't know if I've heard of one case of it happening, but that is the potential that if you baptise children and get them into it, sort of bound into the organisation, then they could potentially be cut off by everybody. And, you know, that's just not right. And it's these things I thought about, as well as my own situation.
Okay, so as an elder, did you ever find people getting very emotional and almost broken by this process?
Oh, absolutely. Goodness me. And of course, that's one of the reasons why I was broken. I found it very difficult to recover the things that happened to me and my family. And, you know, we were talking about this a while ago now, and one of the features that really drives it home to me as to why I had to leave. We've known so many people that who are either practicing Jehovah's Witnesses or ex-Jehovah's Witnesses that have committed suicide. You know, we personally know 7 witnesses that have committed suicide. That's a lot.
Do you think that's related to that process?
I think it would be, yes. Some of them, definitely. Some of them, they were being treated badly anyway.
I mean, we think of Christ, the Bible, as being something very loving, kind, forgiving. It sounds like there's something missing.
Well, there is, and if you love the Bible, like, you know, you and I do, when you look at it, you will not see the process that Jehovah's Witnesses go through in order to shun people.
But don't other organisations, other churches do something similar?
I'm sure they do, but, you know, like, for instance, in the 1950s, if I can just mention that the Catholic Church were condemned by witnesses in one of their articles that excommunication was not scriptural. But then 4 or 5 years later, they completely reversed that and brought in disfellowshipping.
Well, I mean, you're starting to paint a picture of something that sounds a little bit cult-like. Personally, I know a chap who was a Freemason who, when he was told he could no longer be a Freemason. He was ejected. He actually also tried to commit suicide because his whole circle of friends were themselves Freemasons. Ian Matteson, I'm sure he won't mind me using his name. What do you think? Do you think it fits the definition of a cult? And now, as someone who's been inside and also tried to get out, and maybe you could tell us something about your process. Well, it's a bit of an overly long question, but your process of getting out, was it? Did it make you think that I'm in something like a cult here?
It's difficult to define a cult, I think. But one of the ways I think you can define it is that in this, if you want to leave, can you leave with your dignity? Can you leave and everything be the same? And with Jehovah's Witnesses, no, you can't. Because if say, I don't know whether you've heard of this expression, a fader, you get what's called a hard leaver, where they're disfellowshipped and they are put outside the congregation. When you get somebody who's a fader, they're starting to have doubts. Maybe the elders will try and encourage them, but they got doubts. But they don't do anything that warrants being put outside of the congregation, but they just fade. And so when you fade, you might go to less meetings. When the grip is being lessened that they've got on you, you might start to then do a little bit of research about the religion, and then you start to find out things that you never really knew to be true. And so then you're a little bit lost as to whether you stay in it or you don't. And the more research you do, the more you find that, well, actually, no, it's not true. Some of it is true, but some of it isn't. And then the treatment of people, it destroys people.
So with any organisation like this, I think most people who join it, that they're enjoying their time in it, don't necessarily think about the origins. When did the Jehovah's Witnesses start?
Well, Jehovah's Witnesses started in about the 1780s. And it was...
17?
Sorry, 1870s. Yes, say that again. The Jehovah's Witnesses started round about the 1870s. And it was with a chap called Charles Taze Russell in America. And he was like part of the Millerite movement. And there were, as you probably know, there were probably a lot of break-offs between the Millerite movement, and there were lots of people forecasting end-of-the-world dates and things like that. And he was one of them. And he started to print a magazine called The Herald of Christ's Presence with a watchtower. And that's how he came to be. And he printed with a chap called Barber, and then they sort of fell out over different doctrines, and so he went on his own.
Well, I know there's a lot of Freemasonry in the United States. Were these people Freemasons?
It's got quite a link towards the Masons. Charles Taze Russell had beliefs that you would be akin to Masons. You know, he was into pyramidology and things like this, and the measuring of certain pyramids represented some things. Some of the things, like the 1914 date, he got from the measuring of a pyramid, because Jehovah's Witnesses believe 1914 is an absolute date for them of when Jesus became king in heaven, invisibly.
Okay, so there's a kind of timetable, it sounds to me, that there's almost mathematically working out of various timetables to do with the way that history is going to unfold.
Yeah, there is. They came up with all manner of dates before the 1914 date. They forecast certain dates in the 1870s. He forecast 1913 at one point, but then didn't realise there was no year naught, because it goes from 1 CE to 1 BCE. So he adjusts it to 1914, but he took that measurement from the pyramid. And then later on, when that didn't happen as they thought it was going to happen, they then introduced other dates, 1925, for instance, and then a chap called J.F. Rutherford, he took over as the president, and then he forecast different dates as well, all the way through actually this last century.
There seems to be quite a lot of teaching to do with the end of the world in the Jehovah's Witness. Is that fair to say?
That's exactly it. When a Jehovah's Witness knocks on your door, they are basically wanting you to become a Jehovah's Witness, obviously. You know, they want to have a Bible study with you, but they preach that this world and the 8 billion people on here are going to be killed unless you're a Jehovah's Witness.
What would you say if you got a Jehovah's Witness knocking on your door? If you sat down with them, invited them in, had a cup of tea, what would be that discussion?
I'm afraid it wouldn't happen. it wouldn't happen because we don't go anymore, and they know that.
No, okay. But, I mean, you must have, I imagine, have kept some of your faith. What's your faith like now?
Well, I'm a Christian. Yeah, I'm a Christian.
Do you have a congregation that, you know, you go to?
No, I don't. No, I believe in certain things in the Bible. I love the Gospels. That's where I am at the moment. Unsure about certain matters, because you have to try and decipher out of the things that you've been taught which is right and which is wrong. And of course, Jehovah's Witnesses, they will always, always stick to what is provided by the governing body in America as truth. And they are, I suppose, warned not to look anywhere else apart from what is printed through the Watchtower. So, you know, that's where you are at.
What about for somebody who's thinking of joining or a new recruit to Jehovah's Witnesses? Because obviously there are some warning signs that the processes within the JWs are things that which actually may be better dealt with by the police. So is there anything? Obviously, these things aren't necessarily going to hit you straight when you begin to join. But have you got anything to sort of say as someone that's been through the whole process to anybody that's a little bit new, maybe a bit green?
Well, I think that when you first start studying with Jehovah's Witnesses, you're only taught the basic understanding of what their teachings are through the Bible. But of course, there are other things that come in later that you are not really taught about as you study. For instance, the judicial process. You know, you don't really know that you're going to have to, if you sin, have to meet with three elders who are going to discuss it with you and ask you intimate questions about certain things. But you've then got other issues which they do talk about now more, but which you have to accept it. This is the way it is done. Otherwise, you've got to leave it in the hands of the elders and accept everything that the elders that they do.
So what if you don't actually agree with what the elders have decided? That's a difficult one, isn't it? Who, you know, say, for example, if you think that they haven't actually reached a conclusion, and if they've investigated something that you think is wrong, who's going to deal with it?
Well, as I said, you have to leave it in the hands of the elders. And if you disagree, then you have to disagree silently. Because if you start sharing things that you don't agree with, then you start to become a person that they will look at about sort of marking you and things like that. And, you know, you can end up being on the other side of a judicial committee.
What about women?
Well, women are a valued member of the congregation, but they are not allowed to be teachers from the platform. They're not allowed to hold positions of responsibility either, so they can't be elders, they can't be ministerial servants.
Well, not even, for example, if you have a woman who is particularly articulate, maybe has some sort of gift?
Well, yeah, they can use that in the ministry. Because every Jehovah's Witness has to become a publisher. But if you're a woman, you simply cannot hold positions of responsibility, full stop.
How did you find that? Did you think that worked?
Well, now I'm out of it, I think it's wrong, because I've met wonderful women and they have got such talents which are not put into practice in the Jehovah's Witness religion, because, as I said, they can't hold responsibility. They might be extremely intelligent. You have women who are so much more clever than the elders, but they can't be elders.
Now, what about gay people? Because that's something that nowadays is really looked on as a special, I suppose, a special type of person, that it may be even legally entitled to all sorts of extra protections?
Mm. Well, I'd have to put it this way. You can be gay, but you cannot practice it. So, you know, you have to abstain, basically. You know, I have known situations where somebody has been gay and they've ended up being disfellowshipped for it many years ago. And that person was simply broken because they can't be who they really are. And at the same time, if they are disfellowship, they're then cut off from those that they formerly had really good relationships with, friends, possibly not family. They might be the only one in it. But it just breaks people when they can't be who they are, really. So
I think maybe the most troubling thing you've talked about here is this whole idea of having a kind of parallel judicial system to the state. And actually, you've got, as we've had in the church, you've got an incentive, really, to deal with things in-house and not to let the police know about matters. Did you ever feel as an elder that there were things going on in your congregations that should have been better dealt with by the police?
Absolutely. And one of the things that I now think about that should have been done, you know, from the start, really, was that if you look like the child abuse issue, when I was an elder, you had to phone the branch and they would give you direction. And based on that direction, it was whether you were required to report legally. And of course, there's the two witness rule that years ago that if a child was abused and that child would speak, you know, to the parents, it might be a very young child, but because there's a good relationship encouraged between the parents and the child, then the parent would go and speak to an elder, and then the elder would, his main thing to do straight away is to phone the department, the legal department at the branch, and they would discuss it with him what he had to do. Whereas we all know that the best thing to do for the child is to report it to the authorities, and they are the best ones to deal with it. And I don't wish to be, I can't think of the word, but I don't want to put elders down, but they are not qualified to deal with child abuse. Absolutely not. They are just elders. They are electricians, window cleaners, gardeners, you name it, but they are not qualified to deal with child abuse. The authorities are the best ones. And I must just add this, that if you phone the branch, you cannot go against that, what they say either. You have to follow it to the letter of the law.
In Russia, authorities have actually decided to ban the Jehovah's Witnesses recently. Now, that's a fairly extreme measure. Do you think they've got a case?
It is, but I am a great advocate of freeness of speech. So I think what they've done in Russia is wrong. The Jehovah's Witnesses should be allowed to practice where they want to.
The trouble is, of course, that the Russian authorities are saying pretty much what we've just said, that they cannot have a parallel judicial system because actually what it's doing is it's circumventing the law. It's actually allowing crime to take place.
Yeah, and I think that it's something that has come to light and is being dealt with slowly but surely. You've talked about Russia, where they banned them and called them an extremist religion. In the Netherlands now, they didn't realise that there was a separate judicial system running. And when they found out about this, and of course people have come forward that have had complaints about the way that things have been handled in the Jehovah's Witness religion, the Dutch authorities now are starting to do something about it. You know, they want it handled the best way that they know how to.
Well, the way you've described it, I don't imagine there'll be a lot of Jehovah's Witnesses listening to this broadcast, but if there are people that know JWs, is there any good books around which go into a bit more detail so that people can kind of clue up? Because the way that societies like the JWs operate is they don't allow anybody to find out what's going in. And in a way, it's been very privileged for you to having been an elder yourself. You've seen it from the inside. Is there any books or other places people can go to find out more about how it really works?
Well, one of the publications that helped me to really see another side. And I've always been fascinated with the way that the governing body operates. I thought that, as Jehovah's Witnesses tell you, that they were being guided by God. But there was a book written by a chap called Raymond Franz, and he was a member of the governing body from about 1970 to 1980. And
this is in the US, is it?
This is in the US, yeah, because their headquarters is in the United States. And he was a member of the governing body by the name of Raymond Franz, and he actually was disfellowshipped. And it was for the simple reason that he left and he had a meal with somebody who was disfellowshipped. And so they disfellowshipped him for it because he's not allowed to associate with somebody like that. And so he, after a couple of years of being prodded by lots of ex-witnesses, please tell us your story. What's it like being in the governing body? And so he wrote a book called Crisis of Conscience. And I read that, and that's what really helped me to, we call it waking up, because then you're starting to think outside of the box.
So you think Jehovah's Witnesses are encouraged not to think outside the box?
Well, they're encouraged to only read the information that Jehovah's Witnesses provide. So therefore, if something is negative about the religion, then they aren't actually, well, they could read it, but of course it's not a good thing for them, because then they'll start to see the other side. Then they'll start to kind of wake up, as you call it, but just to stick to the information that's provided by them.
And how have you found it, leaving? Because when you leave, suddenly, you know, you're all of your contacts, friends, family, the people that esteem you as an elder, everyone's gone.
Well, it is. It's difficult. And one of the things that you really have to do, if you've made up your mind to leave, is to start to reach out to others and form other networks of friends. Because if you stop and you just leave it, you know, like a hard leave, you lose everybody, especially if you're disfellowshipped, because they're not allowed to talk to you anyway. But you have to then start to reach out to others and try and get some kind of social network going so as you've got friends, because we all need friends. I mean, that's why a lot of people join the Jehovah's Witness religion, is because they might be on their own. They might be like I suppose you could say a vulnerable person. Not all Jehovah's Witnesses who join were vulnerable. But if you're lonely and then you're sort of grabbed by all these witnesses who come to the Kingdom Hall and they sort of what call love bomb you, and they all become your friends, but then you realise, well, maybe it's not what you thought it was, you lose your whole social network. So therefore you need, if you're going to leave, to start making other friends.
And is there any specific thing you'd say to anyone that's knows anybody in one of these organisations that will actually get them to start questioning a bit more?
Yeah, there are various websites that you can look at, but there's a little phrase that I learned, and that was, I'd rather have questions I can't answer than answers I can't question. I know that was not an original JW saying, it was from somewhere, but that's a really good one, because we've all got questions and we should be able to question things.
And you can't, you think?
Not really, no. Well, you can, but you can't voice it.
Fascinating. Anyway, Ed, thanks very much for joining.
Okay, thank you.